Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fascinating Nouns, your destination for incredible people, places, things, and ideas. A nexus point for the intriguing, interesting, invigorating, weird, wild, wacky, the fun, the frivolous, and the fringe. I'm your host, Daniel J. Glenn. Tonight, we're going to talk about Alcatraz. History has proven it impenetrable and inescapable. The terrain is hostile, the inhabitants criminal. This is where our next guest was brought as an infant and raised to adolescence. Chuck Stucker has turned that unique childhood into a lifelong passion, documenting the island of Alcatraz throughout its history as a part of the Americas. Chuck, thank you for being here. Now, what years were you on the island exactly?
Well, I came there with my family in 1940. My father had been transferred to Alcatraz in 1939 from Leavenworth Penitentiary, but I was not born until May of 1940. We were unable to get accommodations on the island till October of 1940, and that's when I arrived on the island with my family. I was about 4 months old. And
you didn't come in shackles. You had the unique distinction of not coming.
No shackles. I came as a bundle.
Okay. That's adorable. So was your father a career correctional officer or whatever they call
Yes, him? He had found his way to be a correctional officer in 1928 when he started at Leavenworth Penitentiary. And that was after kicking around the country and trying to find his way. He was born and raised in Leavenworth, but he ran away from home at 16, rode the rails out to California, joined the Marines. And by the time he got back from China, he was about 19 years of age, and he was set to create a family. He went to work in some lead mines, which had collapses, and he decided that was not for him. And luckily for him, he became a correctional officer, which many people did during the Depression years.
So he really wanted to work in a dangerous career.
Oddly enough, it was never considered dangerous by him. My father was one tough fellow. I could never match his standard for what he did. I learned early on not to become a correctional officer. That was a tough job, and you need to be a tough person.
Yeah. So when you were on the island, were you in the prison when people were in there, like when the inmates were in there, or was it?
Well, now we have to go. You know, as a baby, I can't tell you much about what it was like when I was a baby. My sister, who was 13 years older, she was 13 at the time we moved to the island, and so she has better memories of that time. To get you up to my memories, though, we have to cover a few bases. World War II came along, mm-hmm. 1941, the end of 1941, and it was patriotism to the max. Mm-hmm. You talk about patriotism for 9/11. Well, it was even more so when World War II came along. My father, who had a family, two children, was a correctional officer, which was a position that kept you out of the draft.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's
interesting. You were draft exempt. He re-enlisted. He re-enlisted at 40 years of age, and they took him. And we had to leave the island because he went back into the Navy. You know, originally, he was in the Marines. They took him back into the Navy. He was not unique. There was a great drain of officers during World War II to where they put a stop to it. They actually stopped you. They reduced the age requirement to be a correctional officer from 27 to 21, and they started advertising in the newspapers to backfill these positions, which created some interesting stories on Alcatraz. When the war ended in 1945, my father got his job back right away, but it took 3 years before we could get some open accommodations back on Alcatraz, mm-hmm. at which time I was 8. And we moved back to the island into the bachelor officers' quarters. Kind of interesting because we were a family, but I moved into the bachelor officers' quarters at 8. And ultimately moved into other dwellings throughout the island until I left at age 13. So in terms of your question about inmates, I tell people time and again, inmates didn't mean anything to you unless it were pointed out as being something special. They were adults in gray uniforms, and you didn't have much to do with adults when you were that age. I did help them. collect our garbage and help them collect our laundry. They did all the laundry. You'd wrap it up in a big sheet with your name on it, of course. All your clothing was named because it went to the prison laundry. And I would help them do that just for fun.
That must have been really difficult to keep everyone's underwear in order.
Well, it was like being in the military where you have all of your garments named, and so it came back to you if it had your name on it. Some officers, though, if they were not liked by certain inmates, it may come back in damaged condition or overly starched. This happened. And women, of course, didn't send their female garments because it would never come back.
Right, that makes sense.
This is a given. But in terms of knowing the inmates, actually knowing and having anything to do with the inmates, I didn't. I didn't want to, and I had no need. Only if one was pointed out. There was a fellow by the name of Cook, as I remember, that was brought to Alcatraz. He was a serial killer. He was not a federal penitentiary person, as I remember, but they sent him to Alcatraz on his way to San Quentin, where he was executed. And I did see him come onto the dock because it was a special event kind of thing.
Right.
But for those first inmates, the first 32 inmates were military holdovers. So they stayed because the military left them. They became number one to number 32. Then there was an inmate or two brought in by the federal government, and then a whole bunch of inmates came at one time. I was going to say maybe 80. The number could be off, but it was three rail cars.
Wow.
And they were put in these rail cars in Atlanta, in Leavenworth, and who knows where, and they were transported out to a Tiburon, as I recall. And at Tiburon, they didn't take the inmates out of the rail cars. They loaded them onto barges in the rail cars, and they brought the barge over to Alcatraz and unloaded them on Alcatraz.
Wow.
And there was a whole lot of inmates. I have some photos showing the inmates on the dock. But at that time, the kids that were lucky enough to be there knew they were coming, and they saw them come off the rail cars and saw them get marched up the switchbacks to the back of the prison into the recreation yard. And that to me was one fascinating time. Al Capone was part of that group. And
you were there. You saw
The kids were there. I was not born yet. That was in 1934.
30. I was going to say that was early.
But the kids that were there tell some great stories, and I do have the photos. But no, I missed that by about 6 years, and I was too young to care. But your question was back to the inmates and children. They didn't want you to have contact with them, but a few kids did have contact, depending upon the situation. The inmates would come, if they had special talents, like being an electrician, like being a plumber, they would use these talents to help fix a problem in your dwelling, for example. Mm-hmm. And my sister recalled being frightened when one came into the house where we were living to fix a problem. And that inmate said, "Are you the Stuckers from Leavenworth?" he knew my father from Leavenworth, and it frightened my mother and her. But of course, he was not alone. He was with a correctional officer. They would never be alone.
Right.
So there were contacts, but it was few and far between. And depending upon who you talked to, they might have received a baseball from an inmate. The guard may let him do that or some kind of thing.
Well, let's go on, because I found this kind of fascinating with the inmates in general. I think the what's the quote I have that the inmates were only guaranteed food, shelter, medical care, and clothing. I think
that's right, and
that was all they were guaranteed.
That's right.
And literally everything else that they did was a privilege that they had to earn. So even doing laundry was a privilege because then they could, you know. So, I mean, how did, what other things were they able to do? I mean, what were some of the the highly desired jobs people wanted?
Well, as I know it from other people, of course, I was too young at that particular time, and as I grew up, the most privileged job on Alcatraz was to be a pass man. And a pass man is equivalent to a trustee in any other prison, but the term pass man was carried over from the military times. In military documentation, they called them pass men. Now, there were only two pass men, to my knowledge, but there could have been more. And they provided a service to the warden. Warden Johnson, for example, had two pass men, and I believe that probably carried through to the other wardens as well. But for him, he had two pass men. Warden Swope had pass men. He was the next warden. The pass men would be able to come in and out of the prison through the main entrance by pass, and they would be recognized, and they would not have a correctional officer with them, and they would do services for the warden. One would cook, and one would house clean.
So they're like butlers.
They were like butlers, but they were called pass men. Of course, this is a unique job because you were not supervised. You could come in and out of the prison to the warden's house. And so they were really had the most freedom of anybody on the island. I know they were pass men, for example, because I used to go fishing in later years with Warden Swope's wife. And when I'd knock on the door, the pass man would answer. His name was Montgomery. And, of course, I didn't pay any attention to him as a person because he just opened the door. But many years later, when I was on Alcatraz, I ran across him again, and we had a nice conversation. But from that, the other jobs that would be desirable would be possibly kitchen service. Work in the kitchen, you have access to food. The dock duty was great duty. You would go to the dock and do various things on the dock. There would be 10 or 12 or more of the inmates on the dock doing dock service, unloading barges, loading, and so forth. The model shop where they made furniture, they repaired furniture. They had a huge laundry where they did all the laundry for everybody, including the Army and the Navy. During the war, they made submarine nets. They repaired buoys. And I don't know what other activities they did, but these were the activities that would get you out of the prison into these various entities to where you do the job. I mean, they were paid, I believe, a nominal sum, but what they acquired that was more important was good time. You could acquire good time. I have a ratio somewhere. So many hours would result in so much good time, which would be taken off of your sentence, your total sentence. Because you didn't know how long you would be in Alcatraz, but your total sentence would be whatever you were tried for. It could be reduced.
So you could you could work hard, and they would use that time
yes.
against your time in prison.
Yes.
Wow.
That was good time. And there's a great story about an inmate that partially escaped in 1945. His name was Giles. He lost 10 years of good time by that escape. But that's a story. That's another story off track from where we're going right here.
No, I want to get to these. I mean, because you've kind of established yourself as someone who knows the history of Alcatraz. So actually, before we get too far ahead, can we talk about a little bit of the history, the unknown history, you know, going back
right.
to the island? Let's start there, because I do want to get your take on the escapes, because it's, you know, it all kind of worked its way back. So from what I was reading, the indigenous peoples were actually were fearful of the island before anyone came, you know, to the island itself.
It's very difficult to know about what the native people in the area thought about Alcatraz. There's a number of stories written about that. But to my best knowledge, they didn't use it for anything other than possibly gathering some bird eggs or some eggs, or they didn't use it for anything. It had birds on it. It was like a big round dome of an egg. And there's stories, there's some legends written about it, but I can't quote them. I have a book that refers to some of those. But as far as I know, they didn't use it for anything. But when the first facility was installed on the island in 1854, it was a lighthouse. And you can understand the need for a lighthouse, because the reason San Francisco Bay wasn't discovered for many, many years after the Spaniards and the Russians and the English went up and down the coast, was that the Golden Gate is really narrow. Looking at it from the water outside the gate, you'd never suspect anything was there. And it was really kind of dumb luck that a Spaniard fell into the bay, and once it was discovered, it says, my, this is something, because it is a special bay. So when the United States, at the time, came into California and established their presence, they needed something that would provide safety for mariners. So a lighthouse was established there first. And that's when the first families came to Alcatraz. Families meaning men, women, and children. Shortly thereafter, it wasn't long after that, a few years, they established a fort there, Fort Alcatraz. The military did. And there was great fear about foreign powers taking California.
But when is this?
In 1854 to 1859, during that period, they established a fort. And the fear was not only foreign powers, it was a fear of the Southern sympathizers.
So they were moving into the Civil War right around that.
Well, you're talking 1859 to 1860, so you're getting close to... So the politics of the time were really unsettled. And so they established a fort. And what I found through my studies fascinated me. I thought that no one would really be interested in coming out to man a fort. We were in the wilderness at that time. But it turns out that it was a coveted position from West Point. And if you look in some of the early documentation that I found, and I know there's more, and there's probably people who can talk to this more, a number of those high-ranking graduates from West Point were sent out to Alcatraz to help build and man the facility. And historically, many of them went into the Civil War, and many of them became generals in later life and politicians in later life. And their kickoff was the coveted assignment of Alcatraz.
It's funny because when you think of the Civil War, it's always North versus South, and you never think of, well, you know, because we were settling the West, you know, that was very early stages, but you never think of their involvement and how they were influential or what they did. I mean, you never really hear about the Californians in the Civil War, or the, you know.
No, but they were definitely involved, those that came through the military. And the very first prison on Alcatraz, Prison 1, which was down near the dock, it's been documented that some of the very first prisoners there were Southern sympathizers that were arrested in San Francisco. So I'm not real versed at this, but there are historians that have documented the names and the people that were there. And so that always fascinated me. Hey, this is the first prison and Southern sympathizers are here. It's not like the federal years that came later. It was different. And of course,
they shipped them all the way out to Alcatraz from wherever they...
Yes. Wow. And of course, it followed, you can understand this, that in 1906, when the earthquake came about, and San Francisco was utterly destroyed, including the prisons, Alcatraz fared really well, very little damage. They shipped the prisoners out to Alcatraz, however many they could hold, to hold them while they reestablished facilities in San Francisco.
Well, it's not a big prison. Alcatraz isn't, I mean, it's not, physically the island is large and they used a lot of it, but there, I mean, what does it hold, 300 and...
Well, you have to go back in time. I don't know the actual figures for the first prison. And my studies have indicated there have been three prisons there. There were the first prison down near the dock, and I think it had very limited capacity. I don't even want to throw a number out to you, but very limited. The second prison, which was built up on what became the parade ground, established by the military, they actually terraformed the island to create that parade ground. They established what I call prison number two. It had a capacity of 600, and it was, it was quite large in its capacity, as I read. The third prison...
Well, let me stop you there. What was that prison built for, the second prison?
It was built for the military use, of course. It was all military up until 1933. Things were happening worldwide. The Spanish-American War, there were things happening throughout the world in the 1890s, in 1900s, and in 1870s. we were getting more involved in the world. And of course, our troops were, the Army was expanding, and the need for a facility for military discipline had expanded. So it was all military driven at the time, politics in the world at the time.
Okay.
By the time they built the third prison, which was also built for the military, and it's the current prison that you see now, it was started around 1910 and completed by 1913. It only had a capacity, maybe its maximum capacity was 400. There's people that can tell you exact. But the federal years, they never had more than about 305 people in there, so it was much more limited. So I sure would like to know more about these years. I'm telling you about what I have learned.
Sure, yeah.
There is nobody alive that lived there during that time. But I do have a part of a diary that was written in the 1860s, and it was a woman, a lieutenant's wife, that lived in the accommodations that they had at the time. It was called a citadel. It was a rather large building where their personnel lived in, accommodations. It was where the current prison currently stands. I have a diary entry from her from the 1860s, and it's really interesting reading as to how it was to live in the Citadel in the 1860s. I have a letter on hand from the 1870s from a doctor that lived on Alcatraz writing back to his parents. There are very few documents to indicate what it was like to live there during that time. But from my standpoint, I'd like to know more because I think about it. I know when I lived there, we had motors on our craft. They didn't have motors on their craft in the 1860s. It was difficult with the tidal action to get back and forth from San Francisco. I found it fascinating in reading that the last documented birth on Alcatraz, authenticated birth, was in 1906. So prior to that time, families were living differently than when I lived there.
Wow, because one of the things that, you know, really struck me is everyone knows about the inmates. Everyone, you know, prison life is strangely iconic and people look into it, you know, modern prison life, old prison life. Like, how did inmates communicate and how it's so different from the other world? But you have real people who are not inmates living on an island that have to occupy themselves, you know, that have to eat, sleep, you know, live. There's doctors, you know, kids, moms, wives.
Right.
How did they live, you know? I mean, were there activities? What did the kids do for fun, you know? I mean, these are the types of things that kind of blow my mind. You know, this is the stuff that isn't documented. I mean, like, what did you guys do for activities?
I wish I could tell you more about the federal years. I'll tell you about mine. But I'm interested in these years because there is no documentation that has appeared. There may be diaries somewhere. There may be documentation somewhere. I've indicated I have a few. But to me, the sad thing is that there's no documentation that I've been able to find to talk about the family life or the life during that time. There is absolutely nothing been written to date that I'm aware of that shows a spouse's life on Alcatraz. Through the military years, the federal years, there is no woman that I know of that has ever written about this. There are some manuscripts, but they haven't been published yet, and they were during the federal years, but nothing from the military years, nothing about what life was like. And it was so different from when I was there that it's just fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, what did people, you know, it was like pioneer life, but without even the, you know, modicum of civilization that people had in the West, that, I mean, you did nothing. You were on an island.
I know that the women had a great influence about terraforming the island. The women working with San Francisco had soil brought in. The Army had soil brought in. They put plants. They established the growth that you see out there now. I know that that has continued from the time women started to be on the island because the officers and military didn't seem to have much interest. So all of that's unknown to date, and I wish some diaries would appear. I wish some documentation would appear. When you get to the federal years, you start having more information available. Photography was better. You can piece that together better, with the exception that no woman that lived there ever left any diary or written documentation, because I'd like to know how they handled it. I can tell you pretty much how the officers handled it, but not from the family side.
Yeah, I imagine, what cabin fever, did that settle in? I mean, did people go nuts? I mean, were there any strange occurrences that you know that in all of the history you've kind of looked at, strange occurrences like that where someone who wasn't an inmate kind of lost it or...
It had to have happened. I have no knowledge about anybody during my time frame, during the federal years, going stir crazy. The family members. There's only been documented during the federal years, 29 years, as I recall the figures, there were 10 natural deaths. There were 5 suicides and 8 murders. Well, that's in 29 years, and that's really a small amount. For the family members, I'm not aware of any other than some correctional officers died on the island because of heart conditions, because of health concerns. There were times when we were quarantined. If somebody got that kind of ailment, you were quarantined to your living establishment. That happened. And I'm sure during the military years it happened as well, but there's no documentation.
And you say quarantine, you mean diseases?
Yes, if you got some kind of communicable disease that of the time, maybe just named scarlet fever or something of the time, it would quarantine you from, because it was highly communicable, and so they'd quarantine. I never got quarantined. The worst thing that happened to me was the mumps. And actually, that's a story to itself, because they had a bit of special boat to run me to San Francisco because I was dying.
But did that happen?
That happened when I was 10 years old. They decided that my mumps had become inflamed, took me to San Francisco, and they were removed. My glands were removed.
Because they have medical facilities on the island, but that wasn't, they weren't...
No, the medical facilities on the island were just for real emergencies and for inmate emergencies, and I can tell you a couple of stories there. But in my particular case, the mumps, the glands got inflamed and they removed them in St. Francis Hospital in San Francisco. And after spending the week you're supposed to spend or so, they sent me back to the island. Well... It didn't take. The stitches or whatever they used broke, and I was bleeding, and I was choking on my own, whatever happens. But fortunately, there was a medical doctor on the island at the time. He was a naval doctor, and they called him in right away because I could still remember seeing him. He got these forceps, and he came down, and he pulled his big clotted blood out of my throat. And I was able to breathe again. And because it was such an emergency, they called the special boat to Warden Johnson, and they took me back to San Francisco, and I recovered. But that was a unique experience that they had to get a special boat for me. But I wasn't the only person that ran into that. There were broken arms and there were limbs and there were other things that happened on occasion. That's just my occasion.
Yeah. Wow, it is a prison. I'm sure there were riots and people, I assume there would be need for medical facilities. So there was only one doctor or there was a staff?
There was a staff. They had MTAs that had people work with them. That changed over the years, too, and I can't tell you just all the parameters. But what I'm most familiar with is from the daughter of the first doctor. He was Dr. Hess that came there during the federal years. And the reason I'm familiar with him is his daughter is still alive, and I can talk to her. But he came with Al Capone. How that happened, I don't know, but when Al Capone was transferred from Atlanta to Alcatraz, Dr. Hess was also transferred to Alcatraz. So he became by chance the guy that took care of Al Capone the entire time he was on Alcatraz and actually was involved in the transfer of him out of Alcatraz when he completed his sentence back to Atlanta, where he was released. That's a whole story to itself. But Dr. Hess was the full-time doctor on Alcatraz, and he had a staff, and they called MTAs, a staff of nurses, I guess you'd call them nurses. They were all males. And that would make up the core of what took care of the prisoners and any outstanding issue that would happen among the staff that was living out there. When he left, he was replaced by another full-time doctor, and they rotated in some fashion. I mention that because I had an unusual circumstance that happened to me later in life. I had my personal things. I had my gallbladder removed because of problems. And the surgeon that removed my gallbladder turned out to have been a doctor on Alcatraz.
Yeah, get out of here.
No, he was a doctor in 1960. I had left long years before. I was quite a bit older. But
that's incredible.
What happened when he was a doctor was that at that time in 1960, in the years that took place before it closed, they were contracting doctors for a year at a time. And so through whatever happened between the original doctors in the 30s and the 50s, it's changed. But they would contract medical doctors to be there for at least a year. He was there for a year. He would provide the services on Alcatraz. But he removed my gallbladder in later years. And I thought that was kind of an interesting coincidence.
That's unbelievable. Well, let's get back to Dr. Hess. So yep. Is there any chance that he was Al Capone's guy? Was he like his personal doctor?
Well,
because Al Capone came in with syphilis, right? He had it before he came into the prison.
He did.
So, I mean, I don't know if there's any connection. Did he,
he knew about it. They were well aware of it. And he had, as at least my information says, that Al didn't refuse treatment, that he had the treatments of the time, but it didn't take. It didn't provide the long-lasting relief he needed. So Al, based upon Dr. Hess's accounts through his daughter, he had problems the whole time he was on Alcatraz. He had problems where he'd end up in the hospital. He was out of his mind. He was delirious, things like this. He was not in good health when he was out there. And Dr. Hess would have been the guy to speak to that. But only through his daughter do I know that. In essence, he became his personal physician while he was out there, but he was providing service for everybody else as well.
Right.
Let me throw one other little story in.
Hit me with it.
Because we'll leave Al Capone to later. I have a friend by the name of Roy Chandler who was on the island at the time. He was one of the first families, and they left there about 1938 or so. But when Roy was 10 years old, he had an attack of emphysema, and the emphysema, the treatment at the time, there was an adrenaline shot. And I don't know medically, but that's what he had to get. And so his father, because the attack was bad, took him up to the hospital in the current prison building. And you don't have to go through the main cell block to get there. Those of you that have been there to go around the island know that you can come through the basement up through a back way into the hospital. And that's the way Roy was taken by his father. And when they got up there to the hospital, there was an inmate mopping the floor. Well, he was introduced to Roy by his father as Al Capone. This was Al Capone mopping the floor in the hospital, which is where he spent a lot of his time. And he was introduced to Roy, and he shook his hand. And we have this, of course. I have this conversation on video, which is online at our website. But I bring this up because this is the impression you can have as a young kid. Roy was 10, and as he's telling this story to us, and we're videoing to him many, many years later, he's 80-plus years old, he's saying, I can still remember the warmth of that man's hand when I shook his hand. So I thought, wow, that's special. He shook Al Capone's hand, and he still can remember the warmth of his hand. But he had an opportunity then to meet Al because he was introduced by his father, which is the way that would have to take place.
That's unbelievable. And I don't want to focus on inmates, but I did hear one, since we're on Al Capone, one thing that I saw on your website was a pamphlet. There were a lot of activities that the inmates were allowed to do.
Yeah.
And Al Capone, you can speak to this a little bit greater, but he was part of a band. They had a band called the Rock Island. You're showing me a pamphlet now for those listening at home.
Yeah.
This is a scanned copy. This isn't an original, thank God. But so he was in the band. Tell me a little bit about this band.
Well, evidently, I don't know just how it started, but very early on, since Al was number 85, he was only the 85th prisoner to arrive to Alcatraz. Very early on, and a band was established, and they called themselves the Rock Islanders. And Al played the tenor, banjo, whatever it lists there. You're looking at the playbill there. And I copied that playbill because, to me, I say you could reproduce the music that's listed on that playbill now if you wanted to.
Right.
And I've listed the inmates that were part of the band. The group actually continued till the island was closed. I have photographs of the inmate band.
Rotating members?
Rotating members, because this was 20-some years later. It's still going on. There are some photographs showing them playing in the dining hall. So it continued through the whole time. I have never talked to an inmate that was part of the band to ask him questions,
right.
But it did exist, and it was there, and he was a prominent member.
Just even the fact that he played an instrument and played it to performance level and that instrument was the banjo. I mean, if I didn't see that with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe it. I wouldn't believe it.
Well, I have another little facet that I've never been able to confirm about Al. My uncle, by the way, was also an officer on Alcatraz.
I forgot to ask you that. Yeah, both of your uncles.
My uncle and my cousin were officers on Alcatraz as well, and that's part of my family stories I tell. But my uncle helped open Alcatraz up in 1934. He came out and lived there for 6 months or a little longer. My cousin, his daughter, was born, was a very young child when she was there. But in an interview with my uncle that happened many, many years later that I have a copy of, he mentioned something I wished I could have talked to him about. He mentioned the fact that if Al Capone was in another room, his voice was very high and you could have mistaken it for a woman.
His normal speaking voice?
So in doing inquiries about this later, because nowhere in the literature or nowhere any other interview I've ever seen has mentioned it, I did find out from a custodian of Al Capone's background, that there is no existing recording of Al Capone speaking. There is no audio recording.
No kidding.
Available. So, other than my uncle's comment that his voice was very high, it could have been mistaken for a woman, I immediately flashed back to Rod Steiger playing him in the movies. Wouldn't fit with a high voice.
My mind went to Mike Tyson.
There you go.
Wow, that's incredible.
So what my uncle stated on film, that it was high. He had no reason to state that other than he was asked his impressions, and I'm wondering if, in fact, what Al's voice was like. That's one of those things we may never know since there's no existing audio recording. Yeah.
And he wasn't a singer, so...
No.
He wasn't. Well, let's get into some fun stuff about the island. This is, some of the stuff, the island itself, this is what's kind of amazing to me. It is perfectly built as a prison. It's inescapable, people have said. Do you know a little bit about how it was inescapable? The waters are cold, the tides, the rocky shoreline. I mean, can you go over that a little bit?
Well, I can tell you about the tides. The tides are very rapid in and out of the bay. And if anybody that's been to San Francisco, they have to understand that all of the water from the South Bay all the way down to San Jose and all the water from the North Bay, including the rivers that feed out of Sacramento, they all exit out that little opening that's called the Golden Gate. And they go in and out a couple of times a day. Well, that's a whole lot of water. I'm sure there's statistics that show you how many gallons per second that is going in and out. But I can testify that that it's rapid. And one of my favorite pastimes on Alcatraz was the fish. And I used to fish off the island, the San Francisco side, and I could watch the tide go in and out. And those currents were rapid. Believe it or not, I saw items as big as a telephone pole disappear and then pop back up 100 yards later. I don't know how you would deal with that as a swimmer. Swimmers, by the way,
Can I pause you for a second? What was a telephone pole doing out in the San Francisco Bay?
Well, I'm saying it was like a telephone pole because during the winter months when you get to run off through the rivers, in the Sacramento River and in the North Bay, you have all kinds of things that could float down. You know, in 1955, there was major flooding in Yuba City area. You got huge amount of debris that can come down those rivers, especially in the early years. They may have that control now, but I'm not certain. But there are times when large objects end up in the bay.
Wow. Okay. Anyway, I didn't mean to pause you. So
I do know that people have swim from Alcatraz, and I do have some notes on a young girl that swam from Alcatraz. And I'm going to say it was the late 30s. She was a teenager living on Alcatraz. It was probably in the early 30s because she was a military officer's daughter. You can read the newspaper clipping, but she was only about 16 at the time, and she took it in her head to swim, and she did. She had a crew, and I mean, it wasn't like she just jumped off and did it. Right. But she had enough sense to do it when the tides were slack, and every swimmer to date does it when the tides are slack. And she, to my knowledge, was the first person ever to do it. Without a wetsuit, she swam it to San Francisco, and the media got involved, and she got in the newspaper. Today, most people swim it with a wetsuit because of the temperature. The temperatures can vary from sometime in the high 40s to maybe it gets 59 or something. I know there's people that know the exact. But they swim it with a wetsuit because hypothermia can enter into it if you're in the water too long. If you leave Alcatraz during slack tide and shoot for a Muni Pier, which is directly across, it's where one of our boat docks was, you will end up further west from that by the time you get to shore, so you actually shoot toward the ferry building or the Bay Bridge if you're a fast enough swimmer to end up where you want. If you're in the water more than 45 minutes or so and don't have a wetsuit, you're going to be in trouble from a temperature standpoint. So while it's done, and it's done yearly, they have a swim and a run that's done yearly. It seems virtually impossible for anybody else to do it at any time. There's not a swimmer in the world that could swim it during the tides. It's never been done. It's been tried, but it hasn't been done.
Wow.
But there was one inmate, of course, and you might remember you telling me the very last escape, he actually made it to San Francisco. That's a whole other story.
John Paul Scott was one of them. Yeah, he was the last. So he actually escaped.
Yes.
And actually, on some of the interviews I saw that you do, he's the only person who's actually convicted of escaping.
He got to San Francisco.
So how did you know a little bit about that story?
I know exact. I have all the documentation here. I went and I have all of his statements and the Bureau of Prisons documentation regarding that. Makes a much better story when you're with me out in the island so I can walk you through it. But it is a fascinating story.
Well, let's hear it. What happens?
Well,
because the other thing is you have to get out of the prison. I mean, you know, you're talking about these are just the environmental factors of getting off the island and onto the shore and escaping from there. But, you know, the prison's a prison. It's designed to keep you in.
Well, you know, of course, I'm going from documentation.
Sure.
And I'm going from people that were around at the time.
If you embellish and make up a completely different story, no one listening will even
know. No, but I try not to do that because the real story is just as fascinating as anything you
I'd
could think
of. I'd rather the real story.
Andy, the evidence is still on Alcatraz, as I call in their bookshop, which we don't call it a bookshop. I'll leave what we call it out, but it's there, and where they got through the bars. There's some window bars on the inside that make a curve near the top. And while I don't know exactly it happened this way, they managed, John Paul Scott and his partner, managed to get through those bars using some sort of impregnated twine that they could rub back and forth and get through the bars. Now, the way I put it together is this had been going on for some time. It wasn't just John Paul Scott that had worked on this. It was inmates before him as well. These things take a long time in planning, and sometimes you may not complete it, but at least you continue to work on it. So one way or the other, they were the ones that got through this particular set of bars. And having planned it out well, they took along some flotation gear that they had acquired, and all inmates acquire things. They took along some flotation gear, and amazing to me is they took along a long lead of an electrical cord.
It what were the flotation devices?
Well, it was just raincoat gear and any kind of rubberized fabric that you could seal. There's a picture of it somewhere I have, and you could look exactly. Very rudimentary devices to keep you on the surface. I think they had some wooden paddles that they had made, like fins and things like this. But they also had acquired maybe 100 foot or more of electrical cord. They planned this out. And some other items. So when they were able to escape, it was long about 5:30 in the evening in December. And they went out on the Angel Island side of Alcatraz, which doesn't face San Francisco, it faces Angel Island. They went out at 5:30 in the evening, and they climbed a drain spout that comes from the roof to the ground. They both climbed the drain spout up to the ceiling, up to the roof of the prison. And they went diagonally across the roof of the prison. Now, the reason they did this, to our best knowledge, is they wanted to avoid the guard towers. If they went out on the San Francisco side, there's a road tower there that they may well have been seen. So they went this way to avoid the guard towers and went diagonally across the roof of the prison. That's when the electrical cord came in. So this was really well planned out. They tied the electrical cord off, snaked it down the San Francisco side, out of view of the road tower, and they both climbed the electrical cord down to the base of the prison.
Wow.
Then they went, it's hard to explain, but they went diagonally down the hill and over, I'll say over the dale, until they got to the edge of the island. Now, I know this area real well because I used to fish at the bottom of where they came out. It's a sewer outfall. It's still there, sewer outfall. Great fishing at the sewer outfall. They worked their way down the cliffside. Now, the cliff is very, very steep there. And his John Paul Scott's partner fell, and he broke his ankle as he hit the bottom. But John Paul was able to make it all the way to the bottom without falling. I'm not sure how, but he did. And at that point, at the sewer outfall, they got into the water. Well, as John Paul explains it in his interview, they could see the lights of the city. Daylight saving time at end. It was already dark. They could see the lights of the city, and it was kind of foggy and misty, and maybe it was even raining a little bit. But he could see the lights of the city. They both got into the water. His partner was unable to swim with a broken ankle, and he drifted westerly and ended up on what's called Little Alcatraz. Mm. There's a little tiny rock that appears when the tide is out that we call Little Alcatraz. And there's a buoy to mark it when the tide is in so that boats don't get too close to this. Well, he ended up there and was picked up there. But John Paul Scott swam toward the lights in the city. Now, he was a young man in his 30s. Must have been in good shape, and he must have picked the right tides because he ended up making it to San Francisco.
Wow.
And he ended up at what's called Fort Point, which is the Presidio at the time. It was a military base. And he ended up in some rocks at Fort Point. He was about 50 yards or less from going out the gate and possibly ending up on Baker Beach, where he could have got up, but he didn't. He ended up on these rocks. His temperature at the time, as measured in the hospital later, was 94 degrees. Hypothermia had set in. He had, was exhausted. He couldn't pull himself out. All he could do was yell.
Yeah.
So some teenagers who was living on the island, at the, living in the Presidio at the time, heard him, got the military police. They come, they extracted him. They took him to Letterman Hospital, which was on the Presidio base at the time, and they put him in the hospital. They took photographs. You've looked at the photographs to show the damage to his body. He escaped at 5:30 in the evening. He was back in his cell at 11:30 at night. So this is one hell of a story.
Wow. Well, I mean, how did he get out of the prison? I mean, that's the, you know, that's just...
You know, that's... I think he refers to that, but between going in and out of assignments, like the duty and for the dining hall, or duty assignments, there was intervals of time there that were on their own. The reason they knew there was an escape is when they do a head count. You know, they did head counts periodically, and how often they did it in 1963, I don't know, but it changed over the years. But they caught the fact that he was missing because they timed it such that they had a small window of time to disappear. Well, they could have been looking for him within the prison while they were going over the top and down. Once they got into the water and they put boats into the water, I mean, he was already, you know, out of reach, because they did pick up his partner on Little Alcatraz.
Right.
So in terms of the timing, how it worked out, I don't know, but it did work out for him.
Wow. Well, until he got to the...
Well, he escaped, and actually it was probably the nail that closed Alcatraz. Between the escape in 1962, a few months before, where three disappeared, and then John Paul Scott made it to the San Francisco. These were the things that helped close Alcatraz. They'd been talking about closing Alcatraz since the late 1940s. I mean, because of cost, but that's when it did close it. It was shortly thereafter that the federal government closed it.
And you think that was the nail in the coffin?
I do believe it was the final thing they needed. They had enough information. There was a variety of reasons why they wanted to close Alcatraz, but I do believe that was the final thing, the final straw.
Right. Because you're talking about the papier-mâché head, the famous escape in 62.
Yes, which is well written about, which is probably the most authenticated movie version, because there was a fella that was supposed to go with that escape that wasn't able to get out of the hole he created. So, I mean...
And he rolled on everybody and told the whole story.
He told the whole story. The whole thing. You know, the movie was probably as authenticated as you can get as a movie goes, even though it had some flaws.
Right.
That's what everybody thinks about, but they don't think about the two that escaped in 1937 and disappeared. They never seen again.
I don't know much about that. What happened in that one?
Well, I'd have to look at the names. I think it was Coy and Roy. I can't remember their names, but they also disappeared in 1937, the fall of, and they were not seen again. There was quite a hue and cry in San Francisco, as I understand by paper accounts, for about 6 months, and then they were just forgot about. It didn't happen in 62 because they made a Hollywood movie out of it, so everybody thinks about them.
Well, so in 37, they got out of the prison.
They got out of the prison and escaped. There were 14 escape attempts in 29 years. I can't remember how many of the inmates died during that time. There was a number of them were shot and died, and a number of them were picked up and put back into the prison. 14 escape attempts in 29 years.
It's like one every 2 years,
yeah,
on average.
Yeah, and I've been asked by a number of people when I lived there, did I ever part of an escape attempt? And I couldn't remember one from my conscious years from 8 on. And as I studied the literature, that was the time that the warden was Warden Swope. There were no escape attempts during his time as warden. None. There were zero. But... of course, when we first moved there in 1940, my sister, who was older, as that indicated, she remembered a couple of escape attempts and the siren going off and that.
Was she there for the 46, for the Battle of Alcatraz in 46?
No, see, now, my father was there, but we were not living back on the island at the time.
Oh, because you were looking, is that when you were looking for accommodations
yes,
on the island?
Yes, I'd like to tell you that story.
Okay, I'd like to hear it.
Let me tell you that story, because we're only beginning to scratch the surface, but that's a story that I haven't told very often. My father was there in 1946 when the inmates got a hold of weapons. And if anybody wants to study that story, they'll see that Kretzer managed to get up into the West Gun Gallery, managed to subdue a guard, and managed to obtain his weapons. Well, my father was in the basement, a shower room clothing area, at the time that happened. And he sent inmate, he had 18 inmates with him at the time, he sent an inmate upstairs, and the inmate came down immediately, excited. But he wouldn't tell my father what was going on. So my father went up the stairs and looked down the cell block, and he saw an inmate with a gun, and the inmate saw him. So my father pulled a gate shut that was there, pulled it shut, and went downstairs. And the inmate, of course, with the gun, tried to get through this gate, but could not. For one reason or another, could not get through the gate. My father called the alarm in to Cliff Fish, who was in the armory, and told him there's trouble in the cell block. Well, Cliff, being an armory officer, normal trouble doesn't include weapons.
I was going to say, yeah.
So he made a comment to other officers, and they went in, and they were captured. They were taken hostage until somebody finally realized that there was weapons involved. Now, Cliff had his own story regarding this because he's the one that set the alarm off that was heard around the world, and that's a humorous story we'll leave for another day. But my father spent the next 3 days and two nights with those inmates while the war went on. Because as you remember, they called the Marines in. They were using anti-tank grenades through the roof. They were using tear gas. There was over 3,000 rounds of ammunition expended by the officers from the armory. And my father was there in the basement with 18 inmates for 3 days and two nights. And so my part of this story, and once again, remember that I was only a little over, I was 6 years old. We were in San Francisco, and we got the word, and my mother took me down to the Muni Pier dock where there was other families. And it was in the evening. This is one of my first memories. The island was looked like it was on fire. It was well lit up. There was explosions happening. There was things going on. And the dock was full of people. And then along come the Warden Johnson, and on the front of it was a body under a sheet. Well, this is very impressive things to a six-year-old, so I can still see him today. The body turned out to be an officer that was killed and taken out of the prison. But there were other officers that came off the boat, and they were all injured. And one of them was holding his nose, and you know, blood was coming out of his nose. And my mother asked him, "How's Ed doing?" My father, "How's Ed doing?" And the officer said, "He's doing fine. He's okay. He's doing fine." He got in the ambulance and took off.
Wow.
Now, I'll tell you this story because many years later, 40-plus years later, I ran into this officer at one of the reunions. And, and so I told him my memory. I says, "Hey, Bob," I says, "you remember this?" He says, "Oh, yeah. He says, "Remember what you told my mother that Ed was my father?" "Oh, yeah." He says, "I told all the women the same thing. I didn't know what the hell was going on with your father."
Yeah, I was
going
to say, how would he know?
He didn't know, but he was telling everybody the same thing. Oh, he's doing fine. But he's still alive. This officer is still alive. But that's my second earliest memory. My first early memory seems impossible, but it can only have happened. I must have been at 3 at the time. Doubt if I was younger, because we were still on the island. I remember air raids in San Francisco. I remember the lights of the city going out in sections. You've never seen San Francisco go out in sections, but when it was out, it would go off, and you couldn't see San Francisco. I swear you could have lit a match on the wharf, you could have seen it from San Francisco. That's my earliest conscious memory is the air raids during World War II. My sister remembers air raid drills on the island. We had an air raid shelter and all that, but I don't remember that.
Wow.
So that's my story.
That is an
one story.
That's an incredible place to end it. We're out of time, but we could probably talk all afternoon about
this. Well, you've just started. There's many other things, but that's the start.
Well, so for people who want to listen and hear more about you, what are your websites? How can people see these pictures we're talking about?
Well, it's alcatrazalumni.org.
Okay.
And that's where you can see the pictures. Other than that,
Are you guys on social media, or are you
no.
guys are not?
No, I'm not a social media person. Not Facebook, Twitter. But if you email that site, the fellow that maintains that site sometimes sends me questions.
Alcatraz alumni.